Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder that we'll have live coverage of the State of the Union address tonight at 9 o'clock on WNYC. And on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, there'll be a lot going on. For one thing, we'll have a live video feed of the speech. So if you want to watch it on It's Free Country, you can do that. We will have a simultaneous real-time conversation on Twitter going on at the same time. Just add the hashtag that you'll see there if you go IAFC for It's Free Country, SOTU for State of the Union. But you'll see it when you go to itsfreecountry.org tonight. And there'll be a special Twitter stream with everybody who's tweeting about the State of the Union kind of in our orbit. And you can follow along and participate as you watch the speech. We even have State of the Union bingo, which you can play along to. And State of the Union limericks. Here's a good bipartisan, let's all sit together across the aisle one, from Dr. Goose from Glen Ridge, who's already posted, said the president wagging a finger, unemployment no longer may linger. So to send a jobs bill to my desk from the Hill is the task of each left and right winger. So you can see more of those and post your own. And finally, we have a thoroughly unscientific poll on It's Free Country right now. Why will you watch the State of the Union address? So far, 44% of the people are saying to be part of a national moment. Smaller percentages are saying to see who's sitting across party lines, to see if you can fall back in love with the president you voted for, to try and catch senators dozing off or shouting, "You lie," or to root for or against the president and his party. So register your response. Why will you watch the State of the Union address right now on itsfreecountry.org, and then watch it with us there or listen to it on WNYC Radio tonight at 9 o'clock. Of course, we've seen a lot of change in the White House since the November midterms. The president's approval ratings are up. His closest advisors and staff have changed. And the lame duck session in Congress managed to surprise everyone by passing important legislation. So tonight, as we hear the State of the Union address, we'll also be listening to a reflection of the change happening at the White House. On the politics of this, strategists will be reading between the lines of the speech, but our next guest has been looking at what's behind the speech and the recent changes in tone and action at the White House. John Heilman, National Affairs Editor for New York Magazine. His article this week, The Remaking of the President, and he joins me now. Hi, John.
Hey, Brian.
So you described tonight's State of the Union address as an opportunity for the president to, quote, gain some altitude. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that one of the things that the president and his people realized after the midterms was that they needed to try to put him in a place that was presidential. And by that, I mean, they look back on the last 2 years and they felt like in a lot of cases, because of there was so much legislative activity, that he became seen by a lot of people as, you know, being in the weeds as kind of negotiator in chief, or even as kind of a prime ministerial figure, leader of his party, but not as someone kind of above and apart from both parties, which is really what the president, what a lot of people want from the president, what they particularly want from President Obama, given the way that he campaigned back in 2008. So, you know, they, in the lame duck session, by getting where he was in the tax cut compromise and then bring through a lot of legislation to the surprise of many, again, with the Tucson speech after the shootings, which, of course, no one would have wanted that opportunity, but they faced with it. It was an opportunity that was kind of consistent with that theme of trying to get up high and be presidential. The State of the Union is a third big opportunity for him in the space of just a few weeks to try to command those kind of heights and put himself where he wants to be.
And you quote one of Obama's friends as saying what he wants is to be Barack Obama again. What does that mean?
Well, I think that they feel as though, and I think the president feels as though, a lot of the things that he came to Washington to do, and I think he would have said, you know, much to the, somewhat to the consternation of some on the left, that he was elected to be a kind of post-partisan, pragmatic problem solver. That's how he thought of himself as a candidate, and I think he feels as though, to some extent because of mistakes he made, and to some extent because of the kind of relentless caricature of the right-wing media, he got cast as something different different as kind of an ideological lefty. And he wants to I think find that the kind of voice that he had in the campaign to pitch himself again as I said as kind of pragmatic, post-partisan, problem solver, visionary but pragmatic, someone who can help Washington to change in a fundamental way in terms of working together to get things done for the country.
Do you think he took a detour by his own lights because of the situation that he inherited when he came into office? One, obviously, the depths of the fiscal crisis. So maybe they decided that some huge things like the stimulus and renewing the TARP the way they did and the financial regulation bill were all absolutely necessary at the moment. Or the fact that he came in with such large majorities, historic majorities practically, in the House and the Senate, that, oh my God, we've got the opportunity to do health care that we might never have had before. And it may look liberal, even though he was doing it in a compromising way. It may look liberal, but this is the moment, so I have to do this.
Yeah, I think that to pose those two things as an either or is what they call in mathematics a false binary. I think the answer is both. I do think that there's no question that a lot of the things, especially in terms of the fiscal stimulus and financial regulation, those were not things the president had campaigned on. They were not, if you look back at early 2008, before the world economy really took a nosedive, those were not things that were a big part of what Obama was running on. And I think he was, in fact, reacting to those circumstances, had to do a lot of things that he had never wanted to do, hoped to do, or planned to do. On the other hand, as you said, I think he also knew that this window, this first 2 years, was going to be the time when he could achieve some things proactively that were going to be very large. And I think healthcare is the main, and you could even argue the only real example of that, of a big thing that was not brought upon him by the financial crisis, but where he looked at the fact that he had these majorities in Congress. He knew historically that he was likely to have smaller majorities or possibly even lose a majority in the midterms, and said, you know, the first 2 years of my first term is the window to get healthcare done, and I'm going to, in addition to doing these things that are required by the economic circumstances, I'm going to take this opportunity to do one big thing proactively that will be a lasting legislative landmark for my administration.
John Heilman, co-author of the book Game Change about the Obama campaign, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, has the article this week, The Remaking of the President. And you found out that after the November midterms, the president took initiative and started scheduling meetings with people not necessarily in his inner circle in order to get advice from outsiders. Who did he invite, and do you have a sense of what they told him?
That's a big change for him. It's true, yes. And you know, President Obama, for all of his strengths, one of his weaknesses, and one that the president, I think, really came to understand in a pretty profound way over the course of the period after the midterms, was that he is an insular guy. He is someone who's always relied on a tight circle of advisors, does not trust outsiders easily, does not give them access to him easily. And I think he started to realize that that had been a problem for him in the first 2 years. And so he did start to, in some cases on the sly, like literally not telling anyone that he was doing this, started to schedule people on his own to come in from outside the White House, people that he thought of, I mean, you could caricature them as Washington wise men, but people that he thought could bring him an outside perspective on what had not gone so well in the first 2 years, met with these people alone, no staff present, just him and them one-on-one in individual cases in the Oval Office, Tom Daschle, the former Senate Majority Leader, former Chiefs of Staff John Podesta and Leon Panetta, former Reagan Chief of Staff Ken Duberstein, Vernon Jordan, longtime Clinton consigliere and famous African American power broker, and I thought most surprisingly Matthew Dowd, who had been the guy who ran the Bush Cheney reelection campaign in 2004, has fallen away from, you know, became a kind of an apostate, not really a rock ribbed conservative for Matthew Dowd, but still someone quite far afield from the president's inner circle, all coming in to talk to him, saying to him, one of the things they were saying to him was, you need to be less insular. Another thing they were saying to him was they thought he could get business done with the Republican leadership, talking to him about how he had to reclaim the bully pulpit to be less ubiquitous in the media culture, and how he could govern in an age of divided government by using executive orders, by doing stuff that the executive can do unilaterally that doesn't require congressional action, but can still make him, can still advance his agenda on a number of fronts.
And to just expand a little bit on what you said from the article, you report that three weaknesses were identified by Obama and his team in this reevaluation of where they were. that the White House is too insular, as you said, that the White House has been too tactical and reactive in responding to every issue, whether it was the auto bailout or the stimulus. And the third one, that Obama's oratory and communication skills haven't been used well. And that, of course, was considered his big strength, right? Hillary Clinton's critique when she was running against him in the primaries, I've got all this experience and he's got a speech. And yet his oratory and communication skills were not used that well, they decided, in the first 2 years. In what ways, and did he come to agree with that critique?
He did. I think he's embraced all three of those critiques. We talked about insularity already, and I'll talk about communications now. I mean, I think that, you know, what David Axelrod, who's his outgoing sort of his message guru from 2008 and in the White House now, about to leave the White House, David Axelrod said to me that, you know, that he made the analogy with Walter Payton, the great Chicago Bears running back. He said, you know, this is one of the great running backs in history, but there became a time in the trajectory of the Bears where they relied on Payton all the time. It was Payton left, Payton right, and Payton up the middle. They did that with Obama, too, and they overused him in some respects. He, as I said before, he became too ubiquitous, and so there was this notion that rather than holding him back and using him to maximum effect, he was the only guy they put out in front. And in some sense, that overuse devalued him in the public eye. I think the other thing is that they also never really had, partly because they were doing so many things at once, but also because they were not thinking about this in a careful enough way. They never built a narrative where they could explain to people in the country how all this activity hung together, how it was part of a bigger picture, a theory of the case, where what the president's, all of his various policies and programs were doing that would take the country into the future in a way that Obama could explain clearly and convincingly and compellingly. And then the second thing is this thing about tactical and reactive versus strategic and proactive. And I think, you know, a lot of people in the White House now, and not in a spirit of rebuke or meanness, but they put this down to being part of the style of Rahm Emanuel. You know, dealing with trying to get a lot of things done legislatively, Rahm is a very transactional guy. He's a very tactical guy. He's a short-term guy, very focused on winning the day, winning the week, winning the month.
He may want his job back now.
Right, exactly right. I mean, you know, people are joking about whether he might have to, if he doesn't get on the ballot in Chicago, whether he might end up running the president's reelection campaign. I don't think that will happen. But there is this sense that, you know, for some understandable reasons and for some reasons that owe to Rahm's personality, that they lost track of a longer term game of thinking a year or two or 3 years down the road, mm-hmm. and then they lost their sense of strategy and it became too tactical. And I think the president agrees with all three of those. And a lot of what has happened in the White House in the last couple months in terms of personnel and in terms of how he's tried to start to make his case to the country reflect his absorption of those lessons.
But if they've replaced this political inner circle of Emanuel and the press secretary, Robert Gibbs, who's leaving, and David Axelrod, who's leaving, with David Plouffe, who's been the longtime campaign manager, and Pete Rouse, who was his chief of staff when he was senator, are they just replacing some insiders with other insiders? Are they really getting a different view here?
Well, we will have number one, we will have a different press secretary shortly. Number two, Pete Rouse explicitly is not the choice that Obama made to go with on chief of staff. I mean, this was the biggest choice of all. Choosing Bill Daley to be chief of staff was, I think, you know, the seminal choice. And that choice was made. People have interpreted it as the president reaching out to the business community. There's some truth to that. People have interpreted it as a move to the center. There may be some truth to that, a little bit of truth to that. But much more so, this was a choice between Pete Rouse, who was his interim chief of staff, and a total insider, to Bill Daley, who is like one of the most well-wired people in American politics and American business, a guy who is going to bring with him a vast array of contacts outside Obama's inner circle, someone Obama knew but did not know well, was not intimate of the president's. And to make that choice, if he had chosen Pete Rouse, the building, the White House itself internally, there would have been a universal acclaim. Everyone in the White House loves Pete Rouse. Bill Daley, everyone in the White House, nobody knows Bill Daley in the White House, and yet Obama decided he needed to have someone who would force him out of his comfort zone and bring in people, because of his network of contacts, bring people into Obama's orbit who are not there already. And I think that's it was a huge decision for Obama to make, and really reflective of his views about these questions about insularity and the need to be less inbred going forward.
So trying to turn around all three of these weaknesses that they identified. Will we hear this reflected in the State of the Union address tonight?
Well, I think you will. I think certainly, you know, you're going to see the president is going to, I think, try to talk about things that that go back to this question of narrative. I think, you know, the communication skills issue, obviously this is a big communications opportunity for him. He's going to be wanting to talk very much about the long term of the American economy. It also feeds into this question of strategy and a long term focus. He's going to be talking about, not about, you know, passing individual pieces of legislation in the next 6 months. This is not going to be a big policy rollout speech. People will focus on individual pieces like that, but the bigger picture here is Obama trying to sketch out a vision for the country economically that goes longer than this year, longer than next year, that goes 20 years down the road. And whether that means coupling a new kind of fiscal discipline, which I think will appeal to Republicans, with a lot of investment, an investment agenda that kind of harkens back to the early days of Bill Clinton, talking about education, talking about innovation, talking about infrastructure. What do we need to do to build the American economy for the future going forward? And those things, I think, are consistent with some of the things that Obama identified as having been weaknesses in the first 2 years.
And as we run out of time, I think that's the debate that we're going to be hearing tomorrow morning. We've started to hear it over the last few days. The president framing this agenda for spending on innovation and education and infrastructure, and the Republicans are saying, no, there's no such thing as government investment. It's all government spending. So this is just stimulus three, and here you go again.
Yes, and you're exactly right. That is how many Republicans are already starting to doing pre-buttles of the speech before they've even heard it. That is going to be the debate very much, Brian. And, of course, it's a debate very reminiscent of the 1990s. You heard the same thing when Bill Clinton tried to put forward an investment agenda. The president's going to have to be very forceful in terms of defending these things that he wants to do as investments. But he's also, I think, going to, hopefully there'll be some honey in this for Republicans in the sense that I think he is going to say, in order to pay for this stuff, we are going to have to make some tough choices on other elements of real just pure spending that's not investment, and in terms of dealing with the long-term entitlement issues going forward.
John Heilman, National Affairs Correspondent for New York Magazine, writing this week about the remaking of the president on this State of the Union Day. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And don't forget, we do have live coverage of the State of the Union tonight at 9 o'clock here on WNYC, or video coverage. You can watch the speech on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, and participate in our simultaneous Twitter conversation there and other activities. 9 o'clock on the radio or itsafreecountry.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. Film critics A.O. Scott and Dana Stevens break down the Oscar nominations just released this morning. Stay tuned.